Second half of Hebrews chapter 9, the main teaching has to do with the three appearings of Christ. You find these referred to at the end of the chapter. If you look at verse 26 and the second half of verse 26, but as it is, Christ has appeared once for all at the end of the age to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself. Christ has appeared. If you look at verse 24, for Christ has entered not into a holy place made with hands, a copy of the true one, but into heaven itself, now to appear in the presence of God on our behalf. Christ now appears. And in verse 28, and so Christ, having been offered once for all to bear the sins of many, will appear a second time, not to deal with sin, but to save those who are eagerly waiting for him. Christ will appear the second time. The first of these appearings has to do with Christ putting away sin by the sacrifice of himself. The second of the appearings has to do with his standing in for us in the presence of God in the holy place above. And the third will be his appearing at the end of the age to save those who are eagerly waiting for his coming. Christ has appeared. Christ now appears. Christ will appear again. And I'd like to establish an important thing here before we go any further in our study this evening. The imagery of these three appearances is imagery that comes from the worship of the tabernacle. And it concerns the work of Aaron, the high priest, on the Day of Atonement. You see, on the Day of Atonement, Aaron was involved in three appearings like this. First of all, Aaron appeared in all his garments of glory and beauty before the great bronze altar to put away sin by sacrifice. And then once Aaron had pushed his way through the veils into the holiest place of all, Aaron appeared in the presence of God before the Ark of the Covenant to represent the nation in the holiest place of all. And then when the whole ceremony of the Day of Atonement had been completed, Aaron came out of the holiest place of all and walked out into the presence of the worshippers, and he appeared before the nation. And it was at that point that he pronounced the Aaronic blessing. The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face to shine upon you. And you see, the background to the three appearings of Christ is in fact the three appearings of Aaron, the high priest. Aaron appeared to put away sin by sacrifice. So did Jesus. Aaron appeared in the Holy of Holies to represent the people. So does Jesus. Aaron appeared again when the ceremony was over and showed himself to the people. And so will Jesus. Christ has appeared. Christ now appears. Christ will appear again. And that is the basic truth of the second half of chapter 9 of Hebrews. Can I just set these three appearings on one side for a moment and come back to them later on before we come to the Lord's table? In fact, these three appearings of Christ are connected to three sets of imagery. Let me speak about the three sets of imagery in Hebrews 9. First of all, there's the imagery of making a will. And just as a matter of interest, the word will and the word testament and the word covenant are all the same word in Greek. It's the Greek word diatheke. And diatheke is a testament or a covenant or a will. Hekoine diatheke is the Greek for the New Testament. The Old Testament is an old covenant or an old will with bequests in it. The New Testament is the new covenant or the new will with bequests in it. And the writer says, it doesn't matter how vast the blessings are contained in a will, whether money or lands or possessions or jewelry or houses, absolutely nothing can happen until the man who made the will dies. A death must take place before the blessings of the will can be unlocked and released. Until the testator dies, the blessings and the benefits and the virtues of the will or the covenant or the testament are sealed. Nothing can happen till the man dies. That's the point of verse 16, if you care to look at it, where the writer says, for where a will is involved, the death of the one who made it must be established. Suppose a man goes to Africa on a hunting expedition and he goes missing. It is assumed that he has died in the jungle or he's been eaten by wild beasts. But that's an assumption. And if the man has a will at home in Britain, you must first of all find his body or his bones to show that he's dead. Because until you can establish that the man is dead, the blessings of the covenant cannot be released. Verse 16. Where a will is involved, the death of the one who made it must be established. Verse 17 pursues the point. For a will takes effect only at death, since it is not in force as long as the one who made it is still alive. In a sense, a will is quite a useless thing until death has occurred. Actually, if you know that your name's in the will and it's attached to a great deal of money, the will is not only a useless thing, it's a very frustrating thing, because you cannot get the money until the person who made the will dies. You may, if you like, try to speed the death of the testator. And many have done so. Men and women have murdered in order to unlock and unseal and release the blessings and the boons of the will. Half the murder stories on television are about people who have been murdered in order that their death may unlock the blessings of a covenant or a will. And the writer says that even in the Old Testament, under the old covenant and the old will and the old provision, there had to be a death. And that is why Moses took the book of the covenant of God and sprinkled it with blood as a sign that a death had occurred which released the blessings of the old covenant. That's the point of verse 18. And hence, even the first covenant, the Old Testament, the covenant of law, was not ratified without blood. For when every commandment of the law, that's the laws in the Old Testament, had been declared by Moses to all the people, he sprinkled both the book itself and all the people, saying, "This is the blood of the covenant which God commanded you." Verse 22, under the law, almost everything is purified with blood, and without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness of sins. Now the point is, you see, that the forgiveness of sins was part of the will, and it cannot be released until blood has been shed. First of all, then, there is the imagery of the will. Secondly, there is the imagery of the altar. And I wonder if you noticed in our reading that in every verse from 15 through to 17, the word death is used. And in every verse from 18 through to 22, the word blood is used. So verses 15 to 22 are saturated with imagery from the altar, because the altar was a place of blood, and it was a place of death. Look at verse 15, right in the middle of verse 15. A death has occurred. 16. Where a will is involved, the death of the one who made it must be established. Verse 17. A will takes effect only at death. 18. The first covenant was not ratified without blood. Verse 19. When every commandment had been declared by Moses, he took the blood. Verse 20, saying, "This is the blood of the covenant." Verse 21. He sprinkled with the blood the tabernacle. Verse 22. Under the law, almost everything is purified with blood, and without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness of sins. Now, that is all imagery from the altar. And it's there because, as Leon Morris, the great Bible scholar, says, in the Bible, the shedding of blood is a symbol of death. The life is in the blood. That is a principle of the Old Testament economy. The life is in the blood. And if the blood is poured out, then the person dies. The New Testament speaks about the precious blood of Christ. But it's not a reference, first of all, to Christ's material blood, although that is important. It was important that Jesus should die as he died, because without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness. It would not have done if Jesus had been poisoned, because you don't shed blood if you're poisoned. Jesus had to die the way he died, because without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness of sins. The New Testament speaks about the precious blood of Christ. But it is to the preciousness of his death they overcame Satan, says John in Revelation 12, by the blood of the Lamb, meaning that it was through the death of Christ and through the victory of Christ's death that the victory over Satan was won. Jesus has shed his blood. Jesus has died. We are loosed in the blood of the Lamb. We are loosed in the death of Christ. It's imagery from the altar. And the third set of imagery is the imagery of finality. And it's enshrined in that great phrase, once for all, the Greek word, hapax. Once for all. Something that cannot be repeated. Something that has been done and stands forever. Verse 25. Notice the word repeatedly. The contrast between the repeated sacrifices of the old and the once for all sacrifice of the new. Verse 25. Nor was it to offer himself repeatedly as the high priest entered the holy place yearly with blood not his own, year after year after year, sacrifice after sacrifice after sacrifice. Verse 26. For then Christ would have had to suffer repeatedly since the foundation of the world. But as it is, Christ has appeared hapax, once for all, at the end of the age, to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself. And just as it is appointed for men to die once for all, hapax, and after that comes the judgment, so Christ, having been offered once for all to bear the sins of many, will appear a second time, not to deal with sin, but to save those who are eagerly waiting for him. Christ has come to put away sin once for all. Cannot be repeated. Christ is now pleading for you in heaven once for all. Christ is coming again at the end of the age once for all to save those who eagerly wait his appearing. Now I wonder if you can link these three sets of images, the imagery of the will, the imagery of the altar, and the imagery of finality, with the three appearings. First of all, Christ has appeared to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself. And that was an appearing for the purpose of rescue. And there's a great deal in the New Testament to support the view that the work of Christ was a rescue mission. It's a rescue operation. And I wonder if we underplay this today in our evangelism. Listen to these verses from the New Testament. Paul is writing to the young Timothy. Paul is about to be executed. 2 Timothy 3:11. Listen to these words. Paul says to the young lad, now you've observed my teaching and my conduct and what persecutions I endured. Yet from them all, the Lord rescued me. Every Christian can say that. Can you say that tonight? Can you say that from your heart tonight? The Lord rescued me. Later on in that same second letter to Timothy, chapter 4 and 18, he says, I was rescued from the lion's mouth, and the Lord will rescue me from every evil and save me for his heavenly kingdom. Every Christian can say that. Can you say that tonight? I was rescued from the lion's mouth, and the Lord will rescue me from every evil. Can you say that tonight? Peter, in his second letter, 2 Peter 2 and 9, this great statement of faith, make it your own. The Lord knows how to rescue those who are godly. Do you believe that? Jesus was born to rescue you from your sins and from your worst self. From that awful ego which ruins your own life and makes other people's lives a misery. From your guilty past and from your shame. Jesus was born to rescue you. And the only way he could do it was by putting away sin through the sacrifice of himself. He has appeared to put away sin. Secondly, he now appears in the presence of God for us, and that is an appearing to represent us before the throne. Beyond the veil, as Aaron pushed his way through the tent, pushed aside the veil, and went into the holiest place of all, so Christ has pushed through the veil, and he appears in heaven for us. It's a representative work in heaven. He's not up there for himself. Jesus doesn't need to stand in heaven for himself, because that's his home. It's his native air. He belongs there. He's not there for himself. He's there for you. I have a childhood memory that haunts me. We were working class people, fishing people. During the war, things were hard. Money was not easy to come by. And we had to watch the Barbies and Kakani. And as a boy, I was always haunted by a painting I once saw. It still haunts me. I think it was a Victorian painting, rather sentimental. It's the big window of a big house. Outside it's dark, inside there's a party going on. It's a Christmas party. The place is decorated with garlands. There's a big Christmas tree. And outside there are the street urchins. And their noses are pressed against the window. And they're eyeing up the goodies. All the jellies and the tarts and the cakes. And they're envying the children on the inside. That picture haunts me. Because I always knew I was an outsider. And that the party was always happening somewhere else. It was always somebody else's party. And then the son of the house comes out. He has a word with his father. Then he comes out and he talks to the children on the street. All these ragamuffins and the vagabonds. And he brings them in to meet the master of the house and to join the party. The father's son is the champion of the outsiders. And he comes into the world of the outsiders. And he brings them into the house to meet his father and to share the party. Christ appears in the presence of God for you. He's there to represent. First appearing was to rescue. The second was to represent. And the third one is to redeem you once and for all. Verse 28. And so Christ, having been offered once for all to bear the sins of many, will appear a second time. Not to deal with sin, because that's all finished with, but to save those who are eagerly waiting for him. Paul in Romans chapter 8 and verse 23 speaks about the redemption of our bodies. The last redemption of all. Of course, Christians are redeemed now. But the big redemption comes when Jesus comes. In Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 30, Paul writes about the redemption of the purchased possession. We are already Christ's purchased possession. But the real redemption, the real buying back, will come when Christ comes. And there you have, my friends, a synopsis of the gospel. He has appeared to rescue us by putting away sin through the sacrifice of himself. He now appears to represent us before the Father in heaven. And one day he will appear at the end of the world to redeem finally, once and for all. And the real beauty of it all is this, that at the supper, these are all involved. We look back to the rescue. The broken bread and the wine proclaim the rescue. We look up to the representation where he now stands as our high priest to bless us. And we look forward to the great redemption of the last day when Christ will come for the purchase of his own. And then the real party will start. Would you like to be part of that party? C.S. Lewis says in one of his children's books, it's a special party. It gets better as it goes on. And it gets better and better and better and better as it goes on. Not like our parties, you know, where we develop sore heads and sore stomachs and we get tired and we want to go home. And if it's a flat party, you want to go home before the party started. But that party will go on and on and on forever. And it gets better all the way. And therefore the invitation is to come to the feast. Amen. May God bless the preaching of his word. To his name be honor and praise.